Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true? They don't think Christianity's true. They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
Did Charles Darwin have any doubts about his theory? Well, in fact, he did. And if he were alive today, he'd have a lot more doubts about it. Because we're going to talk about Darwin's doubt today. Now, for those of you who have listened to this program for a while, you know Dr. Stephen Meyer has written a couple of groundbreaking books that relate to Darwinism. The first was called Signature in the Cell, and the second is one that came out this year called Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. Now, we had Dr. Meyer on back in June when the book came out, but there's been some new developments that have occurred since the writing of the book. Some reviews have come out, and I'd like Steve to address some of those today. But what we're going to do is review briefly what Darwin's Doubt is all about, and then we're going to get into some of these reviews and give Dr. Meyer a chance to respond to the reviews over the radio program here today. You're listening to Cross-Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. For those of you low on the FM dial, don't go any further. I know you're looking for NPR, but we're actually going to tell you the truth here. That's our goal here anyway. Now, Steve, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you, Frank, and it was great to see you a couple weeks ago in Charlotte, too.
Yeah, that was a phenomenal apologetics conference, and you were kind of the hit of the whole deal, man. That was a great presentation you gave. And in fact, before we get into the heart of the book here, Steve, would you just tell our listeners what your dad told you about worldviews? I mean, this was priceless.
Well, my dad is an engineer by training and a good math science guy. So when I went off to college, he told me, I know you don't want to be an engineer, and that's okay. You can major in anything you want, but just make sure you get 2 years of college math under your belt before you make a decision about your major, because otherwise you're going to be limited in what you can do, because you need to have the math. And so I was at a small liberal arts college, and after you do 2 years of applied math at the college level, pretty much all you can major in is physics. And then I suddenly realized about that time that's kind of what my dad wanted. And so my problem was I was always interested in not only the science, but the questions at the intersection of science and philosophy. So I was taking a lot of courses on worldview. And I took a course on atheistic existentialism. I came home one Christmas, and my dad wanted to discuss my grades with me, and he saw that I'd gotten an A in atheistic existentialism and a B in my most important physics class. And he kind of looked at me with a look that said, you need to give an explanation here. And I started very defensively to say, well, Dad, look, I know this worldview stuff doesn't mean anything to you, or this philosophy classes don't mean anything to you, but the philosophy is really important because it teaches you about worldview. And worldview is important because it helps you understand how other people are thinking and where they're coming from. And everybody has a worldview. And he interrupted me. He said, son, you don't need a worldview. You need a job. And I tried to say, well, that was the expression of a materialistic worldview. I didn't get very far with that. I had to put together a resume and get into the real world. But ultimately, I got a job teaching philosophy at the college level. So I got a job teaching worldview for a while anyway.
So you actually were able to do what your dad was afraid you wouldn't be able to do. You were applying what you learned about worldview to a real job.
To a real job, right.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Plus, you know, when he's now really into the stuff we do on intelligent design. When I went into the philosophy of science, he thought that sounded like a really impractical and abstract field. But when I started showing him all the miniature machines inside cells, the light went on. The mechanical engineer in him immediately recognized the elegance of the design of the things that we were talking about. So,
well, you have an amazing understanding of what does go on inside of living things. You demonstrated that in Signature in the Cell and, of course, the new book, Darwin's Doubt. You write about technical things, but in an understandable way. Tell our listeners what kind of degree you have and how you're able to do this.
Well, my first training was in physics and geology. I did a double major, and I did a minor in philosophy, and later took a fair amount of graduate level math. So, and I got the science and philosophy background. But then I worked as a geophysicist in an oil company for 4 years, doing digital signal processing and seismic analysis. So I got an exposure to the information sciences there. Mm-hmm. And when I first learned about the problem of the origin of life at a conference in 1985 and learned that the problem was essentially the problem of the origin of information, I got really intrigued. And there was a scientist in Dallas who was at this conference that had opened up a window for me to these big discussions at the intersection of science and philosophy, the origin of the universe and the origin of life being two questions that have long fascinated me. And the scientist at the conference was named Charles Saxton. He'd written a book mm-hmm. called The Mystery of Life's Origins. And I began going to his office after work, and we had long talks, and he kind of mentored me. And within a year, I was ready to go to grad school, and I chose to go in the field of the philosophy of science. And I ended up doing my PhD work in England on the question of the origin of the first life, and writing both a history of the subject and looking at the methodological issues of how scientists reason about events in the remote past, how they come to scientific conclusions about the causes of such events. And that work has provided a foundation for me in the work I've done on intelligent design, making a case that intelligent design is not only the best explanation for the origin of, for example, the information that's needed to build a living cell, but also that conclusion is a properly scientific conclusion because it can be framed using the same methods of scientific reasoning that scientists such as Darwin have used. So it's been a wild ride, a very interesting adventure since first getting interested in this back in the 80s.
Well, you do a great job at it, and the new book is called Darwin's Doubt. Those that don't have it need to get it. I have a hard copy, but I just downloaded a Kindle copy today as well. Steve has a PhD from the University of Cambridge in the philosophy of science, and he does a great job of taking technical information and making it understandable to the average person. Now, Steve, what I want to do in this interview, we've covered some of the book before, but I want to give our viewers or our listeners a kind of an overview of the book, and then we're going to talk about some of the reviews that have been made since the book has come out. So we got 2 minutes before the break. Let's just talk briefly about part one of your book, The Mystery of the Missing Fossils. This is Darwin's Essential Doubt. What is that about?
Right, exactly. The title of the book is meant to open up a story, and the story is the story of this particular conundrum that Darwin faced. He understood that the fossil record was not friendly to his theory. According to his theory, the history of life should look like a branching tree, with the trunk of the tree representing the first simple form of life, maybe a one-celled organism of some kind. The branches at the top represent all the forms of life that we have with us today, and all the other branches connecting the branches represent the forms of life that have gradually morphed or changed into the complex forms that we see today from the simple one-celled organism way back at the beginning. The Cambrian explosion is an event in the history of life that troubled Darwin because it's the event in which the first major groups of animals, of complex animal life, come into the fossil record. And rather than doing so gradually, morphing or evolving very slowly from simpler discernible ancestors, what the fossil record actually shows is the sudden appearance of the major groups of animals. And the sudden and geologically abrupt or rapid appearance of those forms of life. So whereas his theory required great expanses of time and suggested that there should be a really continuous and gradual change, instead you see abrupt change occurring geologically very quickly.
So
and this troubled him, and that was the doubt.
So 20 out of the 28 major phyla come into existence very quickly in the Cambrian period. And we'll talk more to Dr. Stephen Meyer about that, more about his book, more about reviews of the book in just 2 minutes. Don't go away. Welcome back to Cross-Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. My guest today, Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of Signature in the Cell and the new book, Darwin's Doubt. We had Steve on in June of this year. It is now October of 2013, and there's been some reviews of the book that we're going to get to and let Steve respond to them. Now, Steve, we pointed out before the break, part one of the book has to do with the mystery of the missing fossils, and even Darwin knew the Cambrian period had 20 of 28 or so phyla come into existence virtually instantaneously, and there's no way that this appears to have happened gradually. It could have happened gradually, and you explain all of that in part one of the book. In part two, the section is really about how to build an animal. Explain what that is about briefly, Steve.
Well, right. The first mystery is the mystery of the missing ancestral fossils. Darwin expected that there would be forms of life, forms of animal life that would be simpler but discernibly related to the forms that first arose in the Cambrian. He didn't know about all 28 or all 20 of the phyla. He knew a few of the major forms, like trilobites and brachiopods. In fact, one of the things that has made that first mystery even more mysterious is that there have been many more Cambrian animals discovered in that seam of rock all around the world that even Darwin didn't know about. And those new animals are also lacking discernible ancestors in the Precambrian. So the Cambrian explosion has become more explosive since Darwin's time. The second mystery, though, is the more profound mystery that I address in the book. And that is the mystery. It's essentially an engineering problem. How would the evolutionary process build these complex forms of animal life, especially in the narrow windows of geologic time allowed by the fossil record? And that mystery has become more acute by what we've discovered about life and what it takes to build and maintain life in the second half of the 20th century and now in the first part of our new century. And essentially what we've learned is that building an animal requires information. It requires digital code in the form of the genetic information stored along the DNA molecule, and it involves other forms of information in a kind of hierarchically organized informational system, the information that's called epigenetic information that's stored beyond the genome. But in essence, you've got to have instructions and control systems to build animals. And this turned out to be a very difficult thing to do. It's very difficult to conceive of how this could be done by the standard neo-Darwinian mechanism of natural selection acting on random mutations. Just to get a quick hit on that as to why that would be the case, imagine a section of computer code. DNA has been often likened to computer code. Bill Gates has said it's like a software program. If you start changing the zeros and ones in a software program randomly, are you more likely to degrade the information that you have in that program, or are you more likely to generate something fundamentally new, a fundamentally new program or operating system?
Yeah, you're
going to degrade
it.
Every programmer knows randomness is not your friend. If you start randomly changing digits, you're going to introduce glitches and bugs, and long before you get a new program. And that same kind of consideration applies to the genetic code. You want to randomly change one gene to produce another gene, you're going to destroy what you've got long before you ever get something that will produce a new protein or a new biological function. So that's a part of the problem.
Now, you go into something here that I had never heard of until I started reading your book, and that is epigenetic information. You just mentioned it a minute ago. I know it's you got a whole chapter on it in here. And I like what you say on, I think it's about page 289 of the book, in an analogy. You say at a construction site, builders will make use of many materials, lumber, wires, nails, drywall, piping, and windows, yet building materials do not determine the floor plan of the house or the arrangement of the houses in a neighborhood. And then you go on to say, in a similar way, DNA alone does not itself direct how individual proteins are assembled into these larger systems or structures, cell types, tissues, organs, and body plans during animal development. Instead, the three-dimensional structure or spatial architecture of embryonic cells plays important roles in determining body plan formation during embryogenesis. Developmental biologists have identified several sources of epigenetic information in these cells. Now, this is, I'm quoting from Dr. Stephen Meyer's book, Darwin's Doubt, page 289. Now, Steve, where is this epigenetic information? And this is beyond DNA now. DNA
beyond
isn't everything.
DNA. In fact, some of the epigenetic information, which is more of a, you might think of it more like analog or structural information.
Uh-huh.
But some of this other information actually ends up determining the specific function that gene products of DNA, the specific function that the proteins that are produced by DNA accomplish. So the proteins will do different functions depending on where they end up in the cell or attaching to different cell membrane targets. So you've got several sources of epigenetic information that we know about, and undoubtedly many others that we don't. There are these targets. They're made of proteins, and they're on the inside of the cell membrane. But it's the arrangement of those targets that ends up determining a lot of how the animal develops. There's also on the outside of the cell membrane a sugar code. Instead of information being stored in DNA, information is stored in the arrangement of sugars. And that information provides signaling instructions that determine the way cells interact with each other. There's also information stored in something called the cytoskeleton, the cell's internal cell skeleton made of one particular kind of protein that's arranged very differently depending on the types of cells that are involved. So there's lots of this kind of information, and I talk about four or five different sources of it in the book, but the developmental biologists have warned me that we're only scratching the surface of our knowledge of this. An organism, and an animal in particular, is a hierarchically arranged, it's a system of hierarchically layered or arranged information. Some information that tells other information when to turn on and when to turn off and when to be expressed and when not to be expressed. So there's a lot of control systems and regulatory systems involved in building animals, and that has to be accounted for as well as just the primary sequences of DNA. One of the arguments I make in the book, which I think is in some ways the most powerful argument against the neo-Darwinian mechanism, is an argument based on epigenetic information. If we realize that building an animal takes more than DNA and the gene products, the proteins. In fact, what we know is that the protein, DNA makes proteins, but proteins have to be arranged into cell types into tissues, tissues into organs and tissues into body plans. DNA only controls the construction of the low-level parts, the proteins. But we need additional epigenetic information is necessary to arrange the lower-level parts into the higher-level structures. Now, the Darwinian theory, neo-Darwinian theory, says that the source of new innovation in the history of life comes from mutations in DNA, mutations or changes in the lowest level of in the informational hierarchy. But now that we know that it takes information at the higher levels to build animals, what that shows is that you could mutate DNA indefinitely without respect to time or chance or number of trials. The universe could be infinitely old. And you would never produce an animal by merely mutating DNA, because all you would get in the best of cases would be new proteins. And those proteins have to be organized into higher structures, and that requires other information that is not subject to mutations in DNA. So the neo-Darwinian mechanism, I think, is now demonstrably false. It simply cannot accomplish the job that's required. So I think it's time to move on, and it's one of the arguments I made in the book.
Steve, you're making it impossible for Darwinism to be true at this point. It was already bad enough when they couldn't explain the origin of the genetic code, but now you're adding on the fact that the genetic code genetic code alone is not enough. You're saying there's all these other forms of information in a hierarchical way out there that just makes Darwinism a fairy tale, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, and you know from reading the book that prior to the chapters on the epigenetic information, I addressed some really formidable obstacles to generating genetic information, and they have to do with the rarity of genes and what's called sequence space, and the immense improbability against generating even a single gene or protein in known evolutionary deep time. But the epigenetic argument really puts that beyond the mere math, and it says it isn't a matter of chance or odds. It isn't a probability problem anymore. It's simply mutating DNA is simply the wrong kind of the wrong kind of mechanism for producing these higher level structures. And oddly, or maybe not so oddly, but this is one of the arguments that is turning a lot of evolutionary biologists against neo-Darwinism. There was a major book that came out in 2003 with MIT Press called "On the Origin of Organismal Form," written by two evolutionary theoretical biologists who, in their opening chapter, highlighted this problem, and they pointed out that neo-Darwinism has, it has no theory of the generative. It explains the little stuff well, but it doesn't explain the big changes that need to take place, like the origin of body plans or animal body plans. And they listed in a table unsolved problems of the theory, one of which was the Cambrian explosion. Another was the origin of form, of biological form. And when I saw that, I thought, hey, we're right back to pre-1859. This is what Darwin was supposed to have explained. And now we have leading evolutionary biologists saying, actually, the standard modern version of Darwin's theory, neo-Darwinism, does not explain the most important thing that needs to be explained, which is the origin of new biological form and structure.
Well, Steve, I've seen you in debates with several leading atheists. Some are biologists, Peter Ward, Peter Atkins, Michael Ruse. How have they responded? We got about a minute before the break. How do they respond to the arguments that you present?
Well, it depends on the debating opponent. Atkins, I think, really knew very little about intelligent design, and he was carrying on a brief against young Earth creationism, but then he wanted to say that self-organizational processes could account for the origin of information, and that debate's on my website. People can listen to it. The debate with Ward was very congenial. He's a nice guy, but he's a nice guy behind the stage. But when he gets on stage, he was sort of personal. But I think my overall impression is that a lot of these guys are good scientists, but they really haven't been thinking about the fundamental question of the origin of information. I think that's the key. There's a number in my book, I look at a number of these new theories of evolution that are being proposed. Many of them have advantages over standard neo-Darwinism, but they don't really explain the origin of information. They often presuppose pre-existing sources of things.
And that's what we're going to talk about right after the break. What do real Darwinists say about the source of information? A gentleman from UCal Berkeley wrote a review of Darwin's Doubt by Stephen Meyer, and we're going to talk about that and give Steve a chance to respond to it. I'm Frank Turek. Back in 2 minutes. Don't touch that dial. Darwin's Doubt, a new book by Dr. Stephen Meyer. And I haven't even given Steve's website yet. He's at the Discovery Institute. And Steve, I think you also have a website for the book, darwinsdoubt.com. Is that right?
I do. And the young under 30 guys at the Institute who are real techie have just really done a great job on it. And it's content rich. There's a YouTube channel now of videos of debates, of interviews, of animations that we have, and then we've got responses to the reviews, the critical reviews. We've got all the reviews of the book, many of them posted now, and so it's a great site, and it's called darwinsdoubt.com.
DarwinsDoubt.com. Check it out. Okay, so far we've talked about part one of the book, The Mystery of the Missing Fossils. Then we talked missing fossils. Then we talked about part two, How to Build an Animal. And by the way, when I was quoting from Steve's book before, I said it was page 289. It's actually page 275. My bad. Then, Steve, part three is After Darwin, What? The Case for Intelligent Design. And you point out, this is in the prologue of the book, you say the fundamental problem confronting neo-Darwinism, as with chemical evolutionary theory, is the problem of the origin of new biological information. And by the way, you point that out in your first book, Signature in the Cell, that Darwinists have to explain where the original genetic code came from. And then in this book, Darwin's Doubt, you point out that they have to explain where new code and new forms of information come to create new body plans. And then you point point out, and this is all in the prologue, so you give a great overview of the book in the prologue when you say, whenever we find functional information, whether embedded in a radio signal, carved in a stone monument, etched in a magnetic disc, or produced by an Origin of Life scientist attempting to engineer a self-replicating molecule, and we trace that information back to its ultimate source, invariably we come to a mind, not merely a material process. For this reason, the discovery of digital information and even the simplest living cells indicates the prior activity of a designing intelligence at work in the origin of the first life. Now, there's been maybe one so far as of this date, one fairly, directed review of your book by a paleontologist from the University of California at Berkeley. His name is Marshall. He reviewed the book, and he tried to deal with the origin of information. Just about every other thing I've read about it, Steve, every other review of your book that I've read about does not deal with that fundamental question, and that's the question you're presenting.
It's really been amazing, Frank. The reviews have been focused on, in some cases, trivialities. There was a review at National Review, of all places, where the reviewer spent the majority of his review just trying to impeach my credibility. He claimed that I misused a single ellipsis in one block quote and went on at length about this. Turned out I was quite prepared to say, "Well, gosh, my bad," but then I read it and found I didn't. You know, it was a correct use of the quote. But in any case, he didn't address the main argument of the book, and many of the critical reviews have done the same. They've been quibbling over the length of the Cambrian explosion and the things that are in the final analysis really irrelevant to the main argument I'm making. Mm-hmm. And so they've tried to quibble about the first third of the book and not really looked at the main argument about information. A happy exception to that was a prominent review published in the journal Science, which is the largest science journal in the United States. The Brits have Nature, we have Science. It was written by a heavyweight guy, someone that I deeply respect for his work in paleontology, Charles Marshall. And it was negative, but the tone of it was different than a lot of the things that we'd had. And the thing that I appreciated most about the review is that he did try to take on the main argument about the origin of the information that would be needed to build the Cambrian animals.
All right, what did he say?
Well, he argued that you would not need much. He didn't say no new information, but he said you wouldn't need a significant amount of information, new information, because it would be possible for the evolutionary process to rewire the circuits that are responsible for controlling how genes are expressed. In the book, I discuss something called developmental gene regulatory networks, which are essentially dynamical integrated circuits that control the expression of genes and help cells differentiate themselves from other cells and organize themselves into larger structures like different tissue types. And he said, look, you could simply rewire those developmental gene regulatory networks, and that would produce different outcomes, different body plans, without needing an infusion of new genetic information. And he also, the way he phrased that is he said that you could rewire the DGRNs, these circuits, as they operate on pre-existing genes. Well, I've written a couple of long, not too long, but significant responses to this claim. And the first thing I pointed out is that these developmental gene regulatory networks are highly immutable. And this is what we know from our experimental work on them. If you start changing these, if you start rewiring them, a catastrophic effects always ensue for developing animals. Like integrated circuits that we design, they're subject to the principle that engineers call the principle of constraints. The more functionally integrated the system, the more difficult it is to perturb it without defect to the whole. And biologists have found the same thing with these circuits that are crucial to animal development. If you start changing them, perturbing them, they shut down and the organism dies and evolution terminates. So in the first place, I pointed out that Marshall's suggestion was implausible based on what we know experimentally. He claimed in his review that these things could have been more malleable in the past before evolution had produced Cambrian animals, but we have absolutely no evidence of that, and his supposition violates the basic tenet of Darwinian or historical scientific reasoning, which is that the present is the key to the past. What we know from present experience should guide our evaluation of the plausibility of hypotheses in the past. What we know from experience is you can't change these things. They're control systems. Control systems require stability. If you start mucking with them, they're going to cease to function as control systems. So I first argued that that was implausible. But secondly, then I pointed out that the rewiring metaphor is actually, anytime you rewire a circuit, you're fixing one material state and excluding other material states. And mm-hmm. that is, by definition, imparting information into a system. So even if you don't need new genes, once you rewire a genetic regulatory circuit, you're imparting information whether you like it or not. So you haven't really gotten around the informational problem. But beyond that, Marshall also begged the question as to the origin of genetic information, because he said these circuits would rewired circuits would apply to or operate on pre-existing genes. And when you read his technical papers, it's very clear that he presupposes a vast genetic toolkit that pre-existed the Cambrian explosion back in the pre-Cambrian period.
I was just going to say, he's only just shoved the information problem back one step, hasn't he?
He's just pushed it back either tens or 100 million of years. And uh-huh. and he's begged the question as to prior genetic information. And in another response that I wrote to his review, I showed that if we're really serious about building animals, there's all kinds of genes that would be needed. We'd need Hox genes, which are genetic regulatory genes. We'd need orphan genes. Every new animal form that we know of has genes that are unique to its individual species, and they're now called orphans. We would also need genes for the basic parts list. Every new cell type that arises with a new Cambrian animal has dedicated proteins that service that cell type. So if you build an arthropod with an exoskeleton, you're going to need the specific proteins that allow those exoskeletons to have their stout body structures. And the particular protein called lysyl oxidase that is present in these arthropod exoskeletons. If you have gut cells, you're going to need digestive enzymes. So you really can't get around the need for new information. Whenever you see new structure arising, there underlies those new structures, new cell types. The new cell types require new proteins. The new proteins require new genetic information. So even if you have what has sometimes been called a pan-animalian genome, all the genetic information for all the Cambrian animals pre-existing the Cambrian explosion back in the pre-Cambrian, you still have to account for where all that information comes from. And Marshall just begs the question as to the origin of that crucial informational endowment.
Now, Steve, obviously he can't answer where the genetic information came from an atheistic perspective. And obviously, atheists could destroy your entire case if they could find a natural source for genetic information. My question is, if macroevolution is such a slam dunk intellectually, then why don't they offer some intellectually sound arguments that are supported by actual evidence that these sources of information can come from a natural source, that information come from a natural source? Why don't they just offer that? I don't get it.
Well, I think they would say, and in fairness to Marshall, he would probably say that, well, natural selection, random mutation produced all that pre-existing complement of genes back in the Precambrian.
Yeah, but natural selection, as you point out in your book, only works on a pre-existing code. So where does the code come from?
Natural selection acts on the random mutations that the mutational process throws up. And
right.
And the problem that I point out in the book is that there are so many ways to go wrong with mutations in relation to the few ways there are to go right, mm-hmm. that random searches are overwhelmingly more likely to fail on the scale of evolutionary time than they are to succeed, and that is with respect to producing even a single new gene or protein. Marshall did not address that argument in the book, let alone refute it. He mentioned my colleague, Doug Axe, who has done a lot of the work, and sort of dismissed it out of hand. But this is a longstanding problem. It's called the problem of combinatorial inflation, or the problem of the rarity of genes and proteins in sequence space. It's a little bit technical, but in the book I break it down. I use an analogy to a bike lock. Essentially, if you think the bike lock is a great way to illustrate this, mm-hmm. The combination of the lock is the one right way there is to go. That's the thing that will give you the functional outcome, opening the lock. There's but every bike lock has a common bike lock has four dials with 10 digits on each dial. That means there's 9,999 ways of going wrong for every way of going right. So if you're a student trying to crack that, you've got a problem.
Hold the thought, Steve. Come back to the bike lock after the break, the bike lock analogy here. And again, the problem, as they don't want to admit, but the source of genetic information is a problem for them. They've got no way to come up with that. They can talk about mutation all they want, but if they don't have a code to begin with, they can't talk about mutation. And by the way, I'm going to ask you about God of the Gaps right after the break. Don't go away. We'll be back in two. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. Our website, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. And by the way, if you don't have our new app, go get it. Go to the App Store, type in Cross Examined, two words, or go on our website, crossexamined.org, and you'll find where you can download the app there. It's for iPhone, Droid. It's for your iPad. It's got a quick answer section on there. So if you're having a conversation with somebody, they say an objection that you're not quite sure how to answer, chances are the objection is on the app. You just hit your iPhone, you get an answer. And we're talking today to Dr. Stephen Meyer, his new book, Darwin's Doubt. It's been out for about 4 or 5 months now, and some folks have tried to review it. One gentleman from University of California at Berkeley, Charles Marshall, has tried to review it. We've been talking about the problems with his review. He's begging the question as to the source of information to begin with, and his rewiring suggestion won't work either. And Steve, you were giving us an illustration before the break as to why this wouldn't work. You were using a bike lock.
Right. Spend a few minutes on it. Right. The problem that the Darwinian mechanism faces in generating new functional information. And I'm likening a section of genetic code to the combination in a bike lock and all the other combinations of characters that won't open the lock as to the other possibilities that are out there that you don't want to get. So if you've got a bike lock with four dials and 10 digits and you're a thief, if you've got enough time, you could probably open the lock by a random search through all the different mm-hmm. combinations. There are 10,000 possible combinations. Only one's going to open it. But imagine if you have a lock that is 77 dials with 10 digits. That's 10 to the 77th possibility. Mm-hmm. There are only 10 to the 65th elementary particles in the Milky Way galaxy. This is such an enormous number that even if every organism that had ever existed was able to generate one new gene sequence looking for one of those 10 to the 77th possibilities, you'd only search 1 10 trillion trillion trillionth of the space. And these are some of the calculations I make in the book, but basically the idea is just as if you've got enough time in relation to a few combinations to search, you can be pretty much guaranteed of success. If you've got enough combinations in relation to the time available, you can be pretty much guaranteed of failure for a random search. And what I show in the book is that the number of combinations that need to be searched to produce even a single gene, to have a reasonable chance of generating a new gene, are so immense that even with the 5 or 4 billion years of evolutionary history on this planet, it's not enough time to search more than a tiny fraction. And so therefore, it's much more likely that the evolutionary mechanism will fail than it will succeed in generating even a single new gene or protein in the known history of life on Earth. If the mechanism is more likely to fail, it means the theory that the mechanism succeeded is more likely to be false, and therefore we ought to reject the theory, which many skeptics of Darwinism are now doing.
Let me go back and wrap all these thoughts up with you if I can, Steve, just to make sure I understand them and for our audience as well. First of all, that's assuming there is a code to mutate, and the Darwinists have no way of
right,
explaining.
Right, and that goes back to the thesis of the first book. The ultimate right. origin of information is utterly unsolved, and everyone acknowledges that.
Right, and secondly, as you just said there, you said, well, if you had this bike lock and, you know, given enough time, maybe you could do it, but there's not enough time in the 4 billion year history of the Earth, taking the old Earth dating. There's not enough time there. But you also said in a previous segment here that that mechanism does not account for new body plans alone. In other words, DNA alone, mutating
exactly.
DNA, even if you had infinite time, it wouldn't matter, correct?
This is only – there are two problems, the origin of genetic information and the origin of epigenetic information.
Okay.
The mutation space is a prohibitive probabilistic problem in coming up with the genetic information. It's the completely wrong type of mechanism to generate the epigenetic information. So even if you could solve the first problem, overcoming those prohibitive odds against generating a single new gene or protein in evolutionary time, you would still have the problem of generating epigenetic information and the body plans that are, and the epigenetic information is necessary to build these new body plans. So you've got, it's kind of a pick your poison thing for the Darwinians. They've got multiple problems that are, stand as impediments to the creative power of the mutation selection mechanism.
All right. So now an atheist at this point, Steve, could say, okay, yeah, you've pointed out a lot of problems. We have a lot of gaps in our knowledge. But Steve Meyer, this is just a God of the gaps argument. In fact, that's what Charles Marshall, in his review in Science of Darwin's Doubt, said you're doing. Respond to that, if you would. Why is God of the gaps?
Yeah, it's another way to say the God of the gaps objection is to say, well, this is just a negative argument. You're
right.
only pointing out problems with neo-Darwinism. You haven't given us any positive reason to believe in intelligent design. And in informal logic, that's known as a fallacy of arguing from ignorance. It would have the following logical form. Cause A is not sufficient to produce effect X, therefore cause B must have done it. But that's not the way we're arguing. I'm not saying cause A in this case would be natural selection and random mutation and other similarly materialistic evolutionary mechanisms. I do argue that the materialistic evolutionary mechanisms are insufficient to account for the origin of the information needed to build new animals. But I also point out that we do know of a cause. We have positive evidence of the capacity of another cause for creating information, of functional information of the kind that's needed in life. And that cause is intelligence or mind. So we're not arguing just from the absence of evidence for one type of cause, we're also making an affirmative argument for the causal adequacy of another type of cause, and that cause is intelligence or mind or conscious rational activity. We know from experience that minds can produce functional information. And in fact, we know that whenever we see information, especially if it's in a digital or alphabetic form, and we trace it back to its ultimate source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. And you read the passage from the prologue of my book in the earlier segment talking about many examples we have of this information in a magnetic disc or in a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book or a section of computer code. Information always ultimately originates from an intelligent source. So when we recognize that the Cambrian explosion is not only an explosion of new biological form, but also new information, I argue that what we're seeing is evidence of a purposive intelligence having acted in the history of life, a mind at work in generating that informational explosion.
So you're saying you don't just lack a natural explanation, you have positive, empirically verifiable evidence for an intelligent cause.
Exactly.
But suppose, Steve, they say, yeah, but like if you use the Rosetta Stone in your book, you say, well, it's quite an obvious inference that if you find a Rosetta Stone with the inscriptions on it, you're going to say, well, it had to be a mind. Well, an atheist might say, well, yeah, of course, because we've seen other humans create inscriptions like that. But we've never seen your invisible designer do such a thing. So why should we believe in your invisible designer?
Well, that's a good objection, and there's a little more subtlety and required to respond to that. But when you're doing historical scientific reasoning, there are two criteria that need to be met. One is a causal adequacy criterion, which says that you need to cite a cause which is known to be capable of producing the effects in question. Mm-hmm. The other criterion that needs to be met is something called a causal existence criterion. You need to show that that cause was actually present in the past. And the objection that you're articulating here is raising a question about not the causal adequacy. Yes, we know that minds can create information, but we don't know that a mind was present prior to the origin of the human mind. And so we can't meet the causal existence criterion of a good historical explanation. But what that objection overlooks is that the causal existence criterion and the causal adequacy criterion are met at the same time in the case when we are looking at an effect for which there is only one known cause. When the cause in question is necessary, meaning there's no other cause that we know of that is capable of producing the effects in question, then we can infer the cause from the effect with no additional information. If it's true that where there's smoke, there's fire, if we see smoke coming over the horizon, then we can infer that there was a fire beyond the mountain range that produced the smoke. When we see footprints in the sand, because only feet make the footprints, even if we don't have any other independent evidence of feet prior to those footprints in the sand, we can infer that somebody walked there in the past. Information is that kind of thing. There's only one known cause of it, and so we can establish the existence of some kind of mind because there is only one cause that produces information, and so that the causal existence criterion is met in at the same time as the causal adequacy criterion because of what we know from observing the world around us.
And I think you also point out at the end of the book, Darwin's Doubt, and we're talking to Dr. Stephen Meyer here, just a minute or so to go. But I think you also point out, Steve, that while the genetic information isn't enough to give us a theistic God, when you add in other arguments, which you do, by the way, in the True You series, for those of you that might recognize Dr. Meyer's voice, you're recognizing it not just because he's been on this show and other shows, but because he is the guy that does the True You series, the apologetic series that Focus on the Family put on. And in that series, Steve, you point out we have other arguments for the existence of a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent creator. And so it just makes sense that the same creator of the universe is the same intelligence that created information in life. Am I right?
Right. Well, just from the biology, it is possible because the evidence of design in biology arises well after the beginning of the universe. So it's logically possible that the intelligent designer responsible for the infusion of information into the biosphere is an agent within the cosmos, or it's also possible that it's an agent beyond the cosmos. So the biology doesn't settle that question by itself, but when you look at other arguments like the evidence of the fine-tuning of the universe itself from the very beginning, I think that points to a transcendent source of intelligence, and therefore I think the evidence as a whole points in a strongly theistic direction.
Steve, great show. Go to Steven's website, darwinsdoubt.com, and get the book, Darwin's Doubt. I'm Frank Turek. See you next week. Thanks, friend. See you.